morning. We're delighted to welcome everybody, but especially our students who have come today. And we have students from the Pre-Law Society at the University of Wisconsin. Would they please stand? And is that Madison? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have Lakeland Union High School students. Would they please stand? You've been here most of the students today. You didn't know there was a prize, did you? Neither did I. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Ripon Pre-Law Society students. They were here this morning at the first oral argument, and they are in our overflow room, which is downstairs, and although we can't see them, they are standing, and we welcome them again. The students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. It's a national award-winning program that has brought thousands of students to the courtroom, and the way it works is we invite students to come and listen to oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they get materials about the case we're about to hear. And then they meet with a justice after this second case. Then the justice has been assigned by the court to meet with the students, and the discussion is about the procedures used in the court for accepting cases, hearing cases, and deciding cases. The discussion is not on the substantive matters of the case. Everyone is invited to join the students and the justice in the hearing room after this argument. I'm Shirley Abraham. Let me introduce the court to you all since we've met you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To Patrick Crooks's left is Justice Patience Robinsack. To her left is Justice Michael Gableman. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, with whom you'll meet after this argument. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case for today and our last case for today, 2012 AP 46 CR, State versus Jenkins. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Jenkins is Attorney Joseph E. Redding. Mr. Redding, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Joseph Redding of Gloyuck Limited, and we represent the petitioner Timothy Jenkins in this matter. This case is about a witness who was never called to testify before a jury when the jury had to determine if Mr. Jenkins was the shooter who killed one individual and injured another. Now, this uncalled witness, her name was Sierra Jones. Sierra Jones, she was an eyewitness, and she was a neutral eyewitness. She didn't have any family or romantic ties to Mr. Jenkins. She was the only other eyewitness other than Toy Kimber. Toy Kimber, who was also a victim, was the state's main witness, and he testified, and he was the main witness for the state in the conviction. Sierra Jones, if she would have testified, that Mr. Jenkins was not the shooter, that she gave a description of the shooter having a clean-shaven baby face, something that Mr. Jenkins does not have. Mr. Jenkins has pretty bad acne. And she would also testify that when given a lineup, which included Mr. Jenkins, she did not pick Mr. Jenkins out as the shooter. Now, in this case where Sarah Jones did not testify, there was no physical evidence that tied Mr. Jenkins to the shooting. There was no DNA, no fingerprints, no blood. There was not a gun recovered from this case. The only direct testimony that tied Jenkins to the shooting was that of Toy Kimber, the state's witness and the victim. And Toy Kimber initially, according to the police, told the police that he didn't know who the shooter was, and he also had 9 criminal convictions. So the jury never got to hear both eyewitnesses. The jury only heard one, Toy Kimber.
Mr. Redding, did the attorney for your client, Mr. Jenkins, have any explanation as to why he did not call Sarah Jones?
He did not call Sarah Jones. Not really. I asked him that question, and he couldn't recall. Now, granted, his testimony was 4 years after the crime, after the shooting, and 2 years after the trial, and he had lost his file in a flood. He had mentioned that he was having some problems with some of the witnesses in this case, but he was never able to give me a straight answer about Sierra Jones and why he didn't call her.
Did he ever talk to her, or did his investigator talk to her, or neither?
I don't believe his investigator did. We don't have any evidence we have evidence that he hired an investigator, but we don't have any evidence that an investigator talked to anybody.
Didn't Jones indicate that, did she testify?
She did.
Didn't she say that she talked to somebody from the defense office?
She did. She believes that she may have talked to Mr. Backus in early 2007. This trial happened about in late April 2009.
So what do you make of that?
Well, I found it hard to believe Mr. Backus from the standpoint that he talked to her, and because he wasn't able to give me any explanation about the photo array, that she didn't pick someone out of the photo array. And when my investigator talked to Ms. Jones, she said she told the Detective Mark Walton, that that's Mr. Jenkins. And the report says that she didn't recognize anybody. So either the report wasn't clearly written or it's incorrect.
Did the report say she didn't recognize anybody, or did the report say she didn't recognize the shooter among those in the photo array?
I think it said both.
Okay.
And let me just take a look at the statement again. It would have been on page 200 of my appendix, 200 and 201. Excuse me, it would have been 203 and 204. Through the 8 individual folders, Jones was unable to make identification and stated that she did not recognize anybody in the array or notice any individual which looked similar to the shooter. So it says both. She didn't recognize anybody in the array, and she didn't recognize anybody who was the shooter.
Yes, it depends on how you read that sentence.
It's not the clearest report. I agree.
Okay, thank you.
So I brought a motion for a new trial, and I brought it under two theories. I brought it under Strickland versus Washington, alleging that Mr. Jenkins was denied his right to counsel. And I also brought it under discretionary reversal, interest of justice, arguing that the real controversy hadn't been tried. I just want to back up to some of the facts. After the shooting, the police arrive on scene, and they talk to Mr. Kimber. And what Mr. Kimber tells them, according to Officer Craker, is that he doesn't know who did this. It was dark. Person had a hoodie. They also talked to Ms. Jones. And Ms. Jones gives a very similar statement to that. She says she doesn't know the victims, and she doesn't know the individual who shot the victims. It wasn't until the next day that Detective Wesley, goes to the hospital, and he goes with the photo lineups for Kimber Jones. Excuse me, Toy Kimber. And he presents these to Mr. Kimber. At that point, the identification is made. But again, this is the exact opposite of what Officer Craker said. Now, a week after the shooting, they talk to Sierra Jones. And at that point, she gives a description. And the description was black male, 20 to 21 years old, 5'8", medium build, medium complexion, clean-shaven baby face, and he was wearing a black hooded sweatshirt. And she adds she had never seen the boy with the rifle before, but believes she could identify him. And that's what causes Detective Walton 2 days later to run the photo lineup. In that report also, Detective Walton, she says that she saw the shooter in the face, or she looked him in the face, and she also denied the police had presented Mr. Jenkins' sister's car and said, is this the car that you saw? And it was a burgundy car, and she denied that it was that car. So the trial occurs.
Was there any reason why that you know from the record why police were focusing on Mr. Jenkins?
The only thing in the record is, I believe, Detective Wesley. And he said that they, for lack of better words, kind of rounded up the usual suspects in the neighborhood, talked to some people, and they had reason to believe that somehow Mr. Jenkins was involved.
But he doesn't say why.
They did not. That's the only thing that's in the record.
Could I ask, how far was Kimber and perhaps Jones from the shooter in terms of distance?
I do not know the answer to that. I know they were relatively close to each other when the shooting started, but I don't know the distance from the car.
I mean, do you have a sense that it's, say, within the space of this hearing room? Or, I mean, this is early in the morning, is it not?
Correct.
What time?
I believe it was 2 a.m.
2 a.m. in the morning, so it's dark out?
Correct.
Okay. Now, it isn't dark out here. I can see people in this room.
Correct.
But you don't have any idea.
I don't, and I certainly could supplement my brief to the court with if there is somewhere in the record that says that, but I do not know.
Well, are there street lights on?
I don't believe we have any testimony about that. It was in Milwaukee Street, I think about 38th and Center. So I would assume that there were street lights on, but I don't believe the record is clear about that.
What is...
Mr. Redding, did your client have an alibi witness?
He did.
That was a Mr. McFadden?
Correct. Also known as, I think, Little Frankie.
Did Sarah Jones, have anything to support what McFadden testified to?
She did. Now, she didn't provide a true alibi. She couldn't say where Mr. Jenkins was the moment the shooting started. Okay. But once my investigator talked to her, we found out that she saw Mr. Jenkins coming out of this what's called a trap house, I believe it was 3 to 5 minutes after the shooting, I believe is the time she put on there. So it corroborates the alibi from that standpoint. It's not an alibi, but I believe it supports the alibi because it's truly much, it's not as likely that Mr. Jenkins would have been in the car, shot, sped away, and then kind of made his way back and appeared at the scene. So I believe it would have supported an alibi.
What's a trap house?
I
can't tell you I've ever heard that term before in this case.
My understanding of what a trap house is a bunch of young individuals rent a house. So there's not any parental involvement or and they basically party. There's probably drinking, there's probably drugs. I think one of the witnesses said to kick it with the females.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
So repeat it.
But I want you to.
We'll see what people are interested in.
Sure. He said to kick it with the females, basically to hang out with the ladies.
I probably shouldn't have asked you to repeat it.
Counsel.
Yes.
Those are interesting facts. What's the legal issue?
Well, there are two legal issues. And one is with the Mockner hearing, or the second prong of the Mockner, or excuse me, the Strickland standard. And the second is the interest of justice and basically a paragraph from the Court of Appeals decision about the interest of justice standard and what is required.
This paragraph?
Paragraph 24, I believe.
Okay. Which issue you want to talk about first?
Well, I would like to talk about the Mockner issue, or the Strickland issue.
We had a Mockner hearing, which was designed to see if there was ineffective assistance of counsel, right?
Correct. And Attorney Backus testified. And what the court said was, I really can't determine what Mr. Backus, what his strategy was. He wasn't exactly clear. So the court passed, basically, on deciding on the first prong of Strickland and went right to the second, which it clearly can do. But then the court said, I don't believe there's a reasonable probability that if the error would not have occurred, the result would have been different. But the court said that based upon the testimony of the inconsistencies in Jones's statements. And Jones gave, including her testimony, Jones gave five statements in this case. And there clearly are inconsistencies. And we don't doubt that. But what the court had said was that I don't think the jury would have believed her because of all these inconsistencies. And it's our contention that that's an incorrect application of the second prong of Strickland. We believe that what the circuit court did here was it acted as the 13th juror. And what they said is, I don't think the jury would have believed her, which the court was supposed to be looking at both the eyewitness testimony and see if there's a reasonable probability if there would have been a different result. And I quoted the McCallum case, both the main and the concurrence, because I think McCallum does a good job of addressing this issue, even though it's not an ineffective assistance case. The majority of McCallum said, you know, even though one side may not be believed, it doesn't mean that there can't be reasonable doubt in the grand scheme of things. And so just because a witness is inconsistent, it doesn't mean that this court should take a look at that witness and says the jury, there's no reasonable like that there will be no reasonable probability that if the error wouldn't have occurred, the result would have been different. And I think if you take a look at Sierra Jones and compare or put her next to Toy Kimber and present it to the jury, there is a reasonable probability that the result would have been different. There's a reasonable probability sufficient to undermine confidence in this verdict. This jury never got to hear somebody who was at ground zero, somebody who gave a very similar statement to the state's main witness. Initially, they both said, we don't know who did this. And then the next day, Mr. Kimber knows who did this. And when they talk to my client a week later, she's able to give a description that doesn't match my client. And she would have said, and she claims she said, that she told the police, this is Jimmy, and this picture right here, and Jimmy didn't do it. So I feel that the court applied an incorrect standard on the Strickland prong.
Mr. Redding, yes. Is it fair to say that the issue of credibility that Judge Dallet was looking at, that particular issue is not clearly one way or the other in terms of our case law. In other words, that we have cases that would indicate it's appropriate to look at credibility, and we have cases that say, no, it's really for the jury. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. I think the case law is very sparse on this issue. And certainly, looking at a lot of the cases, I think it makes a difference what type of witness this is. The fact that this is an eyewitness is a very important thing. The fact that that person was there and saw it and smelt it and felt it, that's very important. This isn't a situation where, we get the jailhouse snitches, or I talked to my brother's sister and they said that Henderson wasn't there, I think was the Davis case. This was an eyewitness, and this was a neutral eyewitness who didn't have any ties to these people. And the jury never got to hear from that person. So, yes, Sarah Jones was going to have some cross-examination. There's no doubt about it. Her statements changed over the course of 4 years. But given the fact that she was an eyewitness, boy, that's awfully important.
What's your rule of law, then? It sounds to me like you're saying on the rule of law, that is, whether or not credibility determination by the judge here was an appropriate inquiry. Are you saying, well, depends, can be, can't be, totality of circumstances, depending on what kind of witness or the other circumstances of the trial? I'm interested in a rule of law in this case. So what's yours?
Well, the rule of law is Strickland still.
Well, I know that.
Okay.
But are you talking about vis-a-vis the credibility and whether or not the circuit court can weigh the credibility of a witness, or was the circuit court in error to do that because that's something for the jury? That's what I heard you initially arguing, that it's something for the jury. Now it sounds to me like you're saying, well, it depends. Sometimes it's for the jury, sometimes it isn't. So I just need a little help, because for me the issue of law with regard to the credibility issue is important.
Again, I believe it's Strickland, and I think Strickland says every scenario is a little different, and we have to look at the totality of the circumstances. I don't think if I'm not asking this court to say for eyewitnesses this is what we want.
What you are, I think, advancing is that you're contending that a court's reliance on a finding of a lack of credibility invades the province of the jury. Is that your position?
Correct.
And that is to be determined by a jury. The jury determines credibility. That's your position. So how does that position mesh with what I understand your argument now to be, that it depends. Maybe sometimes they can weigh the credibility and sometimes they can't. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding your position, so I just need clarification.
Sure. I don't believe the judge, post-conviction judge, should ever weigh a specific witness's credibility. What they need to do is take a look at it under the totality of circumstances with all the, and like in this case, with the other eyewitness. And looking at that, understanding that this witness has flaws, is there a reasonable probability that there could be a different outcome, even if they don't believe that witness? Is there still a chance, a reasonable probability, that there'd be reasonable, or there'd be a different outcome? And I believe with Wiggins says, there's a reasonable probability that one juror would have, there is a reasonable probability that one juror would have struck a different balance.
Well, isn't the issue, it appears that way to me, that a trial judge can say, as a matter of law, no one can believe this witness. Matter of law, witness is totally incredible. Therefore, that counsel didn't put her on, it's not error, and can't be prejudicial, right?
Certainly, I believe a court probably can say this witness is completely incredible.
Right. But the fact that one witness gives several variations of what she or he saw or heard, that's not at all unusual, is it?
I don't believe that's unusual at all.
And the fact that two witnesses give different versions of what they saw or heard, both there, both not lying, theoretically, that's not unusual either.
Certainly not in Milwaukee County.
You think Milwaukee County is different than the rest of the world?
Mm-hmm.
All right. But that's not what the judge said.
It is not.
And so you get to where it looks like the judge is weighing this and saying, hey, it's harmless error because no one, she's not very credible. And when you put the rest of the evidence with against this and weigh it all, the result would be the same. Right?
Correct. But I think it's also very important to note that Judge Dallet never said that this witness is incredible.
That's right. Just didn't think that she'd be totally persuasive in light of the fact that she gave, what did you say, five statements?
She did give five statements.
Correct. Five statements, and they don't exactly mesh.
They do not.
All right.
And then also I think the court's got to remember that a verdict weakly supported by evidence is much more likely to have been affected by error. And in this case, we had one person testify that Jenkins was the shooter.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a person who had nine criminal convictions and also initially said he didn't know who did it.
So he had a few problems, too.
He did.
All right.
He did.
Can I, because your orange light is on, can I move you to the second issue? Pardon me?
Absolutely.
This is the interests of justice, paragraph 24 in the Court of Appeals. And I find this interesting under any conditions, but especially in light. Were you here this morning when the first case was discussed?
I was here for part of it.
Okay. The state there took the position that a new trial in the interest of justice should not be granted. And that was an ineffective assistance of counsel case, too.
And I believe the state in this case has asked that there be a ruling or that you, if you bring it under ineffective assistance, you cannot then ask for
That's right.
Interest of justice.
You've got to fit both prongs of Strickland.
Correct.
Is their position. And if you don't, too bad.
Correct.
And they limit the discretionary power of the Court of Appeals. What is not clear, and I brought back my briefs from the other case so I don't have them in front of me, whether the state is posing the same standard here as it did in the other case, and I think not. But we can ask the state.
Okay.
Thank you, Tom. Let me just say, I assume your position is that the discretionary reversal stands on its own feet and is not limited to any particular other ground, and just a miscarriage of justice or case not controversy not fully tried and not fully presented.
Correct. My position is that you can bring both an ineffective assistance and an interest of justice, and you're not limited just because you bring the ineffective assistance.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. We have Assistant Attorney General Aaron R. O'Neill representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. There are two issues in this case for this court to review. The first is ineffective assistance of counsel arising from trial counsel's strategic decisions not to present specific evidence at the trial in this case. The state is asking this court to affirm the decisions of the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals that Jenkins failed to meet his burden of proving his counsel was ineffective under Strickland versus Washington. The second subject presented is this court's authority to grant discretionary reversal in the interest of justice based on the real controversy not being fully tried, involving those same errors by alleged errors by trial counsel. The state is asking that this court determine that discretionary reversal in the interest of justice is not available when it is trial counsel's strategic decision that is the cause of evidence either not being presented to the jury or being presented to the jury. Instead, such claims are limited to the ineffective assistance of counsel context. On the ineffective assistance of counsel.
How do we know it's a strategic decision in this case when defense counsel, trial defense counsel, testified he can't remember?
Right. That is correct. Counsel couldn't remember. As counsel noted in his arguments, his notes were destroyed in the flood, and he did not have a memory of, with respect to Sarah Jones, at least. There is another claim of ineffective assistance of counsel where he did have a pretty clear memory of why he didn't introduce the evidence. But with respect to Ms. Jones's testimony, the record, I think, pretty much makes clear the reason why he didn't call this witness. Counsel indicated a general memory from his investigation of the crime that he had a very difficult time with numerous witnesses that he was investigating as potential for their potential testimony. And I think if you look at the problems with Ms. Jones's testimony, the only real conclusion from the record is that the reason counsel didn't call her is because of all these problems with her testimony. The Strickland standard for deficient performance is objective. And simply because counsel can't remember why he didn't call a particular witness or counsel can't give a reason, or it doesn't matter. What matters is that whether his conduct was objectively reasonable under the circumstances. And in this case,
the trial court or the Court of Appeals or the Mockner Court has to make it up.
They're not making it up. They're looking at the facts of record and coming up with a conclusion to determine why counsel did what he did.
But counsel, I don't think under the trial court's decision, as I recall it, doesn't matter why he did what he did because the trial court couldn't really determine why he did what he did given the testimony. And so the trial court went right to prejudice to determine whether the failure to call was prejudicial, correct?
That's correct. But again, deficient performance is a legal issue, ultimately based on the facts that are found. And if you look at the court's assessment of prejudice, there are several factual findings in there involving the inconsistencies with Ms. Jones's testimony. And from that, based on those factual findings, a reviewing court can reach a conclusion on deficient performance as well.
Okay. Even though the trial court said it couldn't. Yes. Thank you.
Counsel, what if we objectively look at the record and we, too, come to the conclusion that we really can't tell if it was objectively, that we come to the conclusion that we cannot tell if it's objectively reasonable. Seems to me your whole argument as you advanced it was premised on us finding, making that legal conclusion. What happens if we can't? Does your argument fail?
On ineffective assistance of counsel, absolutely not. There is on prejudice, the claim would fail as well. And in this case, I think the considerations of deficient performance really overlap with the lack of prejudice in this case. The reasons counsel didn't call this witness is because her testimony would have been so problematic, and it's those problems with that testimony that also leads to there being no prejudice in this case.
If we are not able to objectively determine that there was effective assistance of counsel, and also then have to go to the prejudice prong, how does that interface with your argument v. vis-a-vis the availability of discretionary reversal for an appellate court?
I think what you're getting at is if there is no, if you can't conclude there's sufficient performance, and our position is with that, that somehow makes the interest of our, makes our interest of justice claim fail. I don't think that's the case. I think in this case you can find that there was an objective reason for counsel not to introduce this testimony.
Yes, but what if we can't?
But if you can't, I still think that because we are talking about counsel's, counsel ultimately made a decision in this case not to introduce this evidence. We may not know what it was, but it was, I think the record's very clear, this was testimony that counsel was aware of. We know that Ms. Jones testified she talked to counsel several times. So, again, I don't think in this case, even if in, under this, the particular facts in this case, I think it's, you can say that reversal in the interest of justice isn't warranted because it was ultimately counsel's decision not to introduce this evidence, even if this court can't conclude that that was objectively reasonable.
Mr. O'Neill, do you think that it's appropriate under the case law for the circuit judge to weigh the credibility in her or his mind as to the witness who was never called?
I'll say it depends. It depends, first, I think, whether we're talking about what the witness would have testified to at trial versus, in this case, for example, what Ms. Jones said about her interaction with counsel. That goes, Ms. Jones' interaction with counsel goes through the efficient performance prong. And so in that sense, if the court says, if she comes in and testifies, I met with him four times, her post-conviction statement, for example, said, I never met with counsel. So there's a conflict between her statement to the post-conviction investigator and her post-conviction testimony. In that sense, the court is allowed to resolve that credibility issue because that is a matter directly relating to counsel's performance. If we're looking at her testimony that she would have given at trial had she been called, I think it's a little bit of a trickier issue because I think, as counsel's pointed out, it's not the trial court's responsibility to determine whether a witness is credible, whether the trial court itself believes the witness is credible, but rather whether the jury would have believed this witness and what impact had this witness testified and all the flaws with her testimony been brought out on cross-examination, whether there's a reasonable probability of a different result at trial. So I think the problem with the defendant's position is by saying, suggesting that the trial court can never weigh credibility, I think it leads almost to an argument that the court almost has to believe this witness, what she would have said. And that's really not what we're looking at under Strickland. What Strickland requires is an assessment of all the facts, and the circuit court has to try to determine, in light of all these facts and in light of all this information that would have come out of trial, what would the jury have done with this witness? Would they have believed her? How would they have weighed her testimony versus the testimony of other witnesses? So I think the circuit court in this case said, I don't find Ms. Jones credible. And that probably was incorrect to do. But I don't think that means that the court erred as a matter of law, because if you look at the court's prejudice decision as a whole, it clearly applied the correct standard of Strickland versus Washington in finding there was no reasonable probability of a different result at trial.
I'll tell you, one of the things that bothered me about this is in regard to the defense attorney, and the fact that the defense attorney was not able to indicate a reason why he did not call Ms. Jones. There, the circuit court didn't get into, was that credible or not credible, that a defense attorney in a first-degree murder case wouldn't remember why he didn't call a witness. And yet, on the second part of this, credibility comes into play. Is that appropriate? It doesn't come into play on one, but it comes into play on the other?
I think the court is not obligated to make credibility findings on a particular witness.
Period.
No, at all, ever. I mean, that's correct. I mean, especially when I think credibility finding would have been appropriate with defense counsel in this case, because we're talking about something, not about potential trial testimony, but we're talking about his actions here. And if the court had said, you can't remember a reason, I find that incredible. This was, you know, this witness was perhaps important. And this is a big case. You should remember that. So, you know, I'm just going to find you didn't have a reason, and I find you deficient. I think the court would be entitled to make that credibility finding, but it didn't make that here. This court has already gone over, I think, some of the problems with Ms. Jones's testimony. In her post-conviction statement, she said, gave a what I think is a very detailed description of what she said the shooter looked like. And that doesn't really mesh up with a lot of her past statements to police. Their first statement, she said, I didn't see the shooter's face because he was wearing a hood and it was dark. She gives a little bit of description in her second statement. But in their third statement, backs off and said she wasn't really focused on the shooter's face.
Well, counsel, we know that eyewitness identification is not the gold standard.
No.
Is that right?
Absolutely. There's always issues.
And you had a witness, the state had a witness that had its own set of credibility problems.
That's correct.
Right? What other evidence did the state have that Jenkins was the shooter, other than the eyewitness?
Other than the eyewitness? There was no dispute he was in the area at the time of the crime.
Where a lot of other people, even at 2 a.m.
That's correct. And I admit there is not much evidence. It relies heavily on eyewitness testimony. There were some comments from a friend of the defendant's that the defendant made after the shooting when they were talking about the shooting, and he said it's nothing to worry about or something like that. And so that sort of showed that, yeah, the defendant was blowing it off.
You're not going to get beyond a reasonable doubt on that.
No, not on that, but I think we have the eyewitness testimony.
The state takes the position, if I'm stating it correctly, that harmless error should be a relevant factor in discretionary reversal. I didn't see that in your brief. I could have missed it. I know that the state is trying to make its briefs and position here consistent, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, are you in charge of the criminal appeals division now?
I'm in charge of our federal court practice.
Pardon me?
And I'm in charge of our federal court filings.
Who's in charge of the state court?
Court of Appeals, it's Sarah Burgundy. And Greg Weber is responsible for the Supreme Court.
Okay. But that's a goal, isn't it?
That is the goal.
Okay.
It's being implemented.
How do you ever get the federal court? You're always here.
Relatively new
I'm
reorganization,
everywhere.
Right? Relatively new,
it's new
reorganization,
yeah. It's
of the Attorney General's criminal division. And I'm sorry if I put you on the wrong slot, but my recollection was obviously wrong about when I got news of your appointments. But I'm right that you're trying to be consistent. So I want to know, what's your position on discretionary review? What is your consistent position on discretionary reversal? Now, in your brief.
Sorry, yes.
Go ahead.
Our position in this case, we are not addressing harmless error in this case. We are talking about, I think, prejudice in this case.
Harmless error is just, isn't that the other side of prejudice?
That's true.
So, and Strickland is a prejudice harmless error test.
Correct.
So you're saying, if I read your brief right, in just a few pages so we can just see what you said, I'm looking at pages 24 through 30.
That sounds right.
31 or 32. Anyway, 31. And as I understand your position, new trials in the interest of justice should not be available when the basis of the claim is trial counsel's decision about admission of evidence. So part of this says Oh, only if it's the trial court's error in admitting or not admitting evidence that can be the basis of discretionary justice, not the trial counsel's error. Do I summarize your position correctly?
That is correct.
Pardon me?
That is correct.
That is correct. Okay. Then I think you take a second position, which is fine, which is, I thought, let's see if you got another C here. There, yep. That your failure to introduce the testimony of Jones didn't prevent the real controversy. And I think in this area, could be at the end of the other one, you take the position that Strickland, the ineffective assistance of counsel, is mutually exclusive of discretionary reversal. If you can't find prejudicial error under Strickland, then the Court of Appeals is barred from a reversal in discretionary interest of justice. Isn't that the state's position?
That's our position when it involves a discretionary decision by counsel, evidence that counsel is aware of, and counsel makes a decision to introduce or not to introduce that evidence.
That's going to be any Strickland case.
Not every Strickland case. I think that's sort of the, although I don't typically see a lot of cases like that, it often involves the introduction of evidence. But it's not often the case where defense counsel actually has a reason for not introducing this evidence. Sometimes it's evidence that's discovered long after the fact, and it's a failure to investigate. And in this case, we're really just taking the position, and trying to narrow it a little bit, mm-hmm. is that when it's evidence of which counsel is aware, which I think this case pretty clearly establishes that is, the defendant's remedy is Strickland, and that's it. And the interest of justice line of cases is really not intended to be a remedy in those situations. We have a very well-developed standard under Strickland. If you read Strickland, I think the Supreme Court sort of assumed that counsel would always have a reason for what he or she did or didn't do, and that's not always
for a good one or a bad one, but
yeah,
something.
There's talk always about, you know, discretionary decisions by counsel, and we should presume that they're reasonable. Court should presume that they're reasonable, and
can't presume that here when there is no reason.
There is no reason given by counsel, absolutely. But again, this Strickland also establishes that it's an objective standard, and I think that puts an obligation on reviewing courts to, you know, at least look and see whether there would be some reason from the record that was developed in the Mockner hearing to determine whether counsel's decision was reasonable.
Counsel, does your argument apply to this court's ability to exercise its discretionary reversal in the interest of justice? Is your argument limiting our ability also?
We're taking the position, we took the position in the Court of Appeals, it applies to the Court of Appeals, and we're taking the position in this court that it applies to this court's power of discretionary reversal as well.
In regard to our power of discretionary reversal, do we simply review whether the Court of Appeals erroneously exercised their discretion, or do we anew exercise our own discretion or choose not to?
I was reviewing this recently, and I believe either situation is possible, depending on, I think, it's how the person asking for relief in the interest of justice frames the issue. And in this case, as I read it, the defendant's not asking for a review of the Court of Appeals decision, but rather for this court to exercise its own independent judgment.
What was the issue how was the issue framed that we took for review? I thought it was framed vis-a-vis the Court of Appeals, but maybe I might have that mixed up with the prior case that was framed vis-a-vis the Court of Appeals.
Your petition for review says issue number one is, was Jenkins denied his first of all, this is the petition for review by Redding.
You got it.
Okay. Go ahead.
The first issue is the ineffective assistance claims, whether they present a significant issue of federal and state constitutional law, specifically relating to the trial court's credibility finding and just counsel's overall performance. As I read that, the way that the issue was framed in the first issue.
That's a Strickland one.
Right. And the second one was the real controversy. Was the real controversy fully tried and is discretionary reversal?
Mm-hmm. Just as presented here by both of you.
That's correct. And looking at briefly at the defendant's argument, he argued both the Court of Appeals and this court have the authority to reverse in the interest of justice. He criticizes the Court of Appeals' reliance on the Burns case for holding that new trial in the interest of justice is not available when the errors by trial counsel, as opposed to, it's only available to remedy errors, evidentiary errors by the circuit court.
It seems rather fickle that our standard of review would alter depending on, if you want to frame it, did this Court of Appeals erroneously exercise its discretion? The last case that we heard, the Court of Appeals did exercise its discretion and granted a new trial in the interest of justice. Here, the Court of Appeals did not exercise its discretion in granting a new trial. Instead, it exercised its discretion and refused to granting a new trial, but it's the same exercise of discretion. Why should our standard of review be altered just because the issue is, I don't mean spun in a negative way, but it's the same issue, it's just spun differently.
Well, this court's authority to reverse in the interest of justice is independent from the Court of Appeals, and as I understand in our argument in the previous case, I'm not...
Which case?
The case I was argued this morning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not entirely familiar with all aspects of the case, but our argument is that the Court of Appeals erroneously exercised its discretion in granting the new trial in the interest of justice because it didn't apply the correct legal standards. That is, of course, a basis for reversing a discretionary decision. In this case, yes, if the defendant had argued that the Court of Appeals erroneously exercised its discretion in denying him a new trial in the interest of justice, I think this court would probably, I mean, unless it's going to conclude that the legal basis on which it did not grant the trial was wrong, you know, most discretionary decisions have to be affirmed by a reviewing court as long as it's spelled out. You know, there's basically a decision given. But as I understand it, the defendant's not asking that. He's asking this court to exercise its own authority to grant a new trial in the interest of justice. If this court is not going to accept the state's argument that a new trial in the interest of justice is not available for Strickland claims like the one presented here, we still urge this court to exercise its discretion not to reverse this case in the interest of justice. Real controversy in this case was that whether one of the victims correctly identified Mr. Jenkins as the shooter. He said he knew Mr. Jenkins from the neighborhood. He was cross-examined about his identification, including his testimony that he immediately identified Mr. Jenkins as the shooter. That was called into question by the police reports that indicated he did not. Counsel also presented an alibi defense that Mr. Jenkins was sleeping in the nearby house when the shooting occurred, and he presented that through Mr. McFadden's testimony. Can't deny that Ms. Jones' testimony would have had some bearing on both of those claims, but at the same time, her testimony really would have been so undercut by her inconsistencies that it just you know, it may have even confused the jury, and we might be here on a different issue of whether that testimony so clouded an issue before the jury that introducing it requires a new trial in the interest of justice. And as was discussed in counsel's argument, her testimony did not really support the alibi defense. It put him nearby. It supported it in the sense that it put him on the porch of the house 5 minutes after the shooting, and he claimed he was in that house during the shooting, but it did not establish that he was actually in the house when the crimes occurred.
Was there anything about her testimony about what he was wearing when he was on the porch, or just that she saw him there?
Just that she saw him. I don't recall if she said, gave the same, you know, any description about a black hoodie or anything like that that the shooter was also wearing. So I don't know that
right.
did anything like that.
Thank you.
And finally, there's this issue of this jailhouse confession that hasn't really been touched on. I just want to say that our position is it's basically entirely incredible. There is really, if there is even evidence that could have been introduced, and I discussed this in my brief, both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals seem to think there really was no way that this evidence was ever going to come in. But even if it did, even if there was evidence that this defense counsel could have introduced, this confession is, to me, just completely unbelievable. The idea that someone would walk up to the defendant in this case in jail and within earshot of another person just come up to them and say, hey, I did this, for no reason whatsoever, not even knowing that the defendant was the person accused in this case. Just, I think he said, I'm going to keep it real with you. I shot these people. I don't think a jury would have ever bought that testimony, and it certainly didn't prevent the real controversy from being fully tried in this case. Unless there are any further questions.
I see and hear none. So thank you, Mr. Counsel. Mr. Redding.
I first want to address the prong one of Strickland. And clearly at the Mockner hearing, counsel didn't give a reason. He wasn't sure about Ms. Jones at all. But I think it's important to note that she was on his witness list, and she was even mentioned by him, I believe, in voir dire.
She was mentioned by one of the other witnesses, wasn't she? Was it Kimball?
He was. I don't know if she was mentioned by name, but I think he said he was talking to some girls. And so counsel knew of that witness even on the day of trial, beginning of trial, since he mentioned her in voir dire. So the fact that he's not able to give a reason of why he decided not to call her makes me believe that he didn't investigate her and he didn't necessarily, it was inadvertence, and not necessarily a strategic decision as required by Strickland. And while the court did say the standard for the second prong of Strickland, I don't believe it applied it. So, but then I want to move on to the interest of justice. And I think the focus should be on, not necessarily on why the jury didn't hear this evidence, but the fact that they didn't hear material evidence, whether it be because of trial court error, whether it be because of trial counsel error, or even, you know, I could see a situation where there's a district attorney error, a Brady allegation that's brought at the same time. And I know counsel brought up, you know, failure to investigate cases involving these. And I think the concern in those type of cases is that defendants are going to bring interest of justice claims, and then they're going to create a new theory. And we saw that in the Maloney case. If you remember the Maloney case, I believe his initial theory was my girlfriend killed my ex-wife. And by the time he got through the 97406 motions, it was the prosecutor who was accepting bribes ruined my case. And I think this court frowned very much upon switching theories.
Counselor, I think that he, at least the way I heard him, I think he made a very narrow argument His argument was when the heir, the claimed heir, is not presenting evidence that the trial counsel knows of before trial, then your sole remedy is Strickland. And he didn't go into these other permutations, I don't think. I thought he was really pretty narrow in what he said.
All right.
You know, the Court of Appeals accepted the state's argument, in effect, citing Burns, that discretionary reversal based on a determination the jury was denied the opportunity to hear important evidence refers to a legal evidentiary error by the circuit court, citing Burns. This is an unpublished per curiam, but it is not consistent with the Anderson case we heard this morning, in my opinion, when the Court of Appeals gave a new trial in the interest of justice.
And again, I apologize. I wasn't.
You agree with that?
That
you want me to repeat it?
I wasn't here for the Anderson case morning, so I apologize.
I withdraw my comment.
I guess my argument is that the trial court's reliance on Burns, that there has to be trial court error, I don't believe is accurate with our case law, including things like Hicks, cases like Hicks.
In fact, it is Hicks that came to mind when I wrote down what the state was saying. When it is evidence of which counsel is aware, I assume that that was phrased to get around our Hicks case. Do you have any thought on that?
I don't.
Okay.
And I have no further argument, unless there are any other questions.
Hearing and seeing none, thank you, Mr. Redding. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, for your arguments today on discretionary reversal in the interest of justice and on Strickland issues that have come up before the court, especially Strickland. That concludes our hearing in 2012 AP 46 CR, State versus Jenkins. This is our last oral argument scheduled for the month of April.
Tomorrow.
You can only hope, right? we have two more scheduled for tomorrow. I believe it's a criminal case and a OLR discipline case. So I'll show up, and I hope the other six do too. And that will be, I hope, the last oral argument. I know it's the last oral argument scheduled for April. We are in recess. The court will meet in closed conference at, is it about 12:20 now? We'll meet at 2 promptly.
Did she say 2 o'clock?